In this episode of Selling Isn't Everything, we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Jelaine Lise, Sherry, one of your dear friends and also a PhD in psychology who, boy, she had a lot to teach us, didn't she?
She did. And she's worked with everybody from the FBI to coming in at Sandy Hook. And she talks about conflict resolution. But more importantly, she gives us frameworks so in our everyday life, we can get through difficult conversations and lead to human connection.
Enjoy the podcast, everyone.
It calls me different things.
I imagine they do. Yeah.
I go by anything as long as it's nice.
Is there anything between, is the apostrophe actually replacing anything? Like, you know, and
no.
Like, do not become
no.
Don't? This, no. Okay.
My father was a Green Beret. My mother was in the Peace Corps. I was the result. Different value system. And they got creative. I mean, it was the 60s. It could have been Moonflower. So I guess I should be a little grateful.
It's amazing. You know, you stopped actually, it was like in the... A Green Beret in the Peace Corps? Like, what?
I always do say, like, people say, how did you get into conflict resolution? How did you get into this work? And I'm like, have you looked at my name? I mean, did I have an option? You know, because I've had to explain my name my entire life, right? So, you know, this is super fun for me, and I've been looking forward to it, mostly because we're friends. And interestingly, Brent, I don't know if you know this, but Jelaine and I are new friends, which I think is rare once you hit this phase of life. To have a new friend that you would consider one of your best friends. And it's a really cool thing. But I think it was, what, only 3 years ago at Christmas that we met?
It'll be 3 years in December.
Okay, so it was 3 years ago.
Yes.
And I was meeting a friend for a drink in a bar. Sounds like a
as one well, does.
As one does. And she used to work for me like 10 years ago. It was Andrea Dopkin. And I hadn't seen her literally in 10 years. And so we caught up. And then she said, you're not leaving. I said, no, I'm leaving. I'm making my husband dinner. Or she says, no, you're not leaving. My friend Jelaine is coming. You have to meet her. You're going to be business friends, but you guys are going to hit it off. You're going to be best friends. You cannot leave. And so I didn't. And sure enough, dinner got made.
Oh.
And then we became hiking buddies and, you know, hiked like every other Sunday with our dogs, with your amazing dogs. And I think the more we got to know each other, it was just like the conversations. It was one of those relationships where they just went everywhere. And so we became good friends. And I am always blown away with the conversations, your opinions, your background, and your humility with all of what you do. I think where I'd like to start, because it really moved me, is you're 17 years old. You leave school. You go to Arizona. Can you just tell the audience a little bit about your origin story, like why you left to go become a horse trainer?
So I grew up, I left home when I was 13. I wanted to ride horses and I wanted to be a professional. I wanted to go to the Olympics. I had all these dreams. And so my grandfather connected me with this wonderful horse trainer who just happened to have her ranch on the border of Mexico in Nogales, Arizona. So I moved in with my trainer and I lived down there. I went to school in Nogales. I was like one of, I think, 5 white students on a campus of 3,000 in Nogales, where I was the minority for the first time. Yet, if you've ever been to Nogales or to Mexico, the culture is just so warm and loving and embracing. And so even though I was 13, I didn't feel homesick or lonely because the culture just wraps you up in a hug and people are just so kind. But in the horse world, and I would go on the road, you know, 20 to sometimes 25 weeks out of the year to show horses back in the 80s, it was, you know, I don't know if I want to just call it directly, like there was racism or if it was a status issue, but if you were white or black and you groomed horses, you were called a groom and you slept in, you know, hotels. But if you were Mexican, you were labeled Mexican and slept in stalls next to the horses. It had a huge impact on me. And so by the time I was 17, and graduating from high school, I had to make a decision. I could either continue to train and try to, you know, go for my Olympic dreams and do all of that, or I could go to school. I could go to university. And I was told by my trainers I couldn't do both. I had to pick one or the other. And I didn't know what to do. And one day I woke up in the morning. I mean, literally, I did nothing but go to bed the night before. But I woke up in extreme pain. And I had a spontaneous pneumothorax. My lung had just collapsed for no reason. But it hurt a lot. And I went to the doctor and the doctor said, you know, showed that it was, you know, the x-ray showed that it was reinflating by itself. There was no reason for it to collapse. I had no health issues, but I couldn't ride horses for 6 weeks. And in that six-week period, I decided, okay, what do I really want to do? What's really important to me? So I was 17, very idealistic. And I thought, you know what? I think that prejudice and racism is just a misunderstanding. And if people could just get together and have real conversations, we could solve this. So I decided I was going to quit riding horses. I enrolled at ASU, which at Arizona State University, because I hadn't taken SATs. I hadn't done any testing or anything. And so being a state school, I was allowed to enroll. And that first semester, I mean, I was 17, freshman. I saw some things happening on campus. I'm like, I want to fix this. I want to get into this. And so I convinced the administration to give me a $30,000 grant at, you know, my freshman year, first semester. And I created a program called Leadership 2000 because in 1987, the year 2000 felt very far away. And so it was called Leadership 2000, and it was a four-day kind of leadership retreat for students that dealt with all the isms and just being a good person. Like, what kind of human being do we want to be as we move into the world? And it caught, you know, some national attention and different things happened. So by the time I graduated with my bachelor's, I already had, you know, basically a consulting business in place. And that's how I got started. And I've never, it's really weird. I mean, I know that we're going to talk about my, you know, my website, and I'll be able to announce my website. I still don't even have a picture up. I've never used a website. I've never had a business card. I've never done any, everything has just been referral. And I've worked in 60 countries. I've worked in almost every major war zone. I trained police in South Africa for 6 years. I've done, I mean, just all kinds of different things, but it's all just because I want to help make, you know, our place a better place. And if I can do that through building relationships with people, that's my mission.
Jelaine, so for everyone listening, so it's actually super interesting. When you say you train them to do what exactly? Or is it to start doing something, to stop doing something? There's such a great story of you, of human connection and finding common ground and all. But when someone asks you, what do you train on? What do you say exactly?
My little tagline is, I help people play nicely in the sandbox together.
Good luck.
But it's really about being able to have, you know, productive conversations. I mean, if you look, so I'm a psychologist, right? So I did my master's and my PhD in psychology. Don't hold that against me. But I love the brain. And if you've ever studied the brain, our brain was designed to keep us in relationship. It's really fascinating. And so I've developed tools that in terms of how to communicate, that if we follow the way our brain wants us to process information, there's almost no reason why we can't stay in a relationship. We may not agree. We don't always have to agree. But we should always be able to find enough common ground and connection that we can disagree but keep the relationship intact. And to me, that's the number one thing that we need on the planet today. We need to be able to have conversations. We need to stop, you know, refusing to talk to people or cutting them out of our lives because we disagree on something. Again, if you look at how human beings were formed, we were designed, whether you believe in a higher power, whether you believe in evolution, human beings were designed to be a we. The human baby is one of the only, we're like one of the only species where we are completely dependent at birth. We cannot survive by ourselves as a human baby. We are completely dependent. And then we're supposed to, you know, reach adolescence and we go through a stage of independence. But the only reason why the human, you know, we continue on as human beings is because then we become interdependent, procreate, live together, and that kind of thing. And as a baby, we're dependent. And if we're lucky to live a really long life, we're dependent when we leave. So we are designed to be interdependent. And yet so much of what's happening in the world and the way we communicate and talk to each other is creating division instead of connection. And so my goal in life is to connect us.
It just occurred to me, you left the house at 13. There was obviously a reason you left the house. And I'm wondering how much of your upbringing and some of the challenges in your upbringing brought you to this work of wanting to help people connect and resolve conflict. I assume that was a factor, but I don't think I've ever asked you that.
I grew up in a household where we didn't have good communication. I mean, I had, you know, my mother was, I was, you know, I actually said this in my book, you know, she was a yeller, like, but she would yell, get it off her chest, and then she was fine. And then everyone's supposed to go back and be happy. Meanwhile, I felt like someone had just put a serrated knife to my gut and left me in a pile of blood. And we never were allowed to talk about anything. You know, if I ever had an issue to discuss, we had to let it go. If anything happened that was negative, you're just supposed to let it go and move on once it got off someone's chest. And that didn't work for me. I mean, maybe I'm overly sensitive, but I want to unpack things. I want to come to a solution. I want to prevent the same pattern from happening over and over again. And because there was no communication in my family that I would consider productive, I was, they say that you teach what you need yourself, right? Sometimes we teach what we need to learn ourselves, and other times we teach what we just really want and crave within ourselves. And I crave that ability to have authentic conversations and unpack things that, again, we don't have to agree, but we do need to be able to share our experiences so that we can find a way to connect and move forward together.
And you've done that and literally like trained with the FBI, trained in hostile countries. I'd just like you to share how you open your book, Leading with Conversation. By the way, it was like my Bible. I use it all the time, like at home and at work and other places because I'm sure we'll get to your framework, but can you just take us back to the day of the Sandy Hook shooting? And I know you had a somatic experience and you were actually called in as one of the people to work with the authority in Sandy Hook. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I actually wasn't at Sandy Hook myself. I actually was called by people who are helping to facilitate some of the aftermath, if I could support their efforts. And so that was my role in that piece, right? But what happened, and I think I did talk about this in my book, I can't remember every story that's in my book, but when people got together, you know, we're in this place in our country right now where everything is just an immediate attack, right? And so, you know, you have some people saying, well, you know, this is a gun issue and we need to get rid of guns and, you know, that kind of thing. And then we had people on the other side saying, well, you know, this isn't about guns. And, you know, all of you guys who are anti-gun, you're, you know, anti-life and, I'm getting confused. Anyhow, we had people who were like saying, this is because of the guns. And then we had people on the other side saying, well, you're all about killing people because you want abortion and that kind of thing. And it was just very, people just get very divided, right? They go into two separate camps and then you're no longer having a conversation. It's no longer about the kids. It's no longer about what's happening. It's for a long time, that was the big division in our country was, you know, abortion and guns on, you know, depending on what side you were on, that's who you voted for. And that's your party. And yet we're so much richer than that. And anybody who is, I'm going to say is pro-choice is also pro-life and, you know, and the fact that they care about people. And that's the approach that they come to it. And people who are pro-life care deeply about people. And that's their approach and how they come to it. And if we could just start with, we all care about people and we all care about what's in the best interest of people. We have a different way of approaching it. Maybe then we could have a better conversation.
Since you've written the book, things have arguably just gotten worse. I mean, it's like, nor did I mean to imply it was. That's it. In retrospect, I kind of retract that statement. But two things have happened. One, of course, is just the polarization, at least in the United States. So, you know, we've all become either a red or a blue, and there's, you know, never the twain shall meet. And to your point, inside that or in that massive gulf between these two perspectives, of course, is a massive amount of common ground that we've all seemed to forget to look at. The thing that's becoming especially troubling today, it seems, Jelaine, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is we now have better tools than ever before to run away from the problem. In other words, there was a really interesting article in New York Times just last weekend of people now building romantic relationships with their AI algorithm and falling in love and doing all the things one might do in a romantic relationship with their AI. And it's like, so it's becoming increasingly easy to detach. It's become increasingly easy to go in the arguably the exact opposite direction of what you're advocating for. We have now better tools and technology to enable us to do so than ever. I just like, do you look at that? Do you get discouraged? Do you get excited? Do you think like, where's your head at in all this? I guess it would be really interesting to get your thoughts on this.
So this is awesome. That's a great question, right? Okay. So let me just, I want to go back to how the brain processes, because I think this will give you the answer, right?
Okay.
So I have a 4-step process, in my book that I call FEED, right? And it stands for facts, explore, which is exploring emotions and experiences, evaluate, which is basically our thoughts, our opinions, our judgments, and then decide when we choose what we want to do. This is how the brain processes. If you think of an alarm clock, the fact is the alarm clock goes off in the morning. We immediately explore how we feel about that alarm. Based on how we feel, we start to evaluate. do I have to get up right now? Can I sleep for 10 more minutes? Do I really want to go to Starbucks? And then based on that evaluation, we make a decision. We either get out of bed or we put it on snooze. That's how the brain processes, but it's not how we show up in conversation. I'm going to finish answering your question, but I'm going to ask you something first. If you think of those four layers as levels, facts, explore your emotions, evaluate, you know, come up with thoughts and perspectives, and then a decision, which layer or which level do you think we leave out of conversation the most?
Probably the facts, but I think there's this really, what happens when you live in a post-factual world?
Well, so right? Hold on. So you say fact, I'm getting
ahead of the story.
Because what we do is that we leave out facts and explore, right? We start our conversations with an evaluation. Like, go back to, and the second we do that, so when we start with an evaluation, and especially a negative, if I said something opposite of you, right? Mm-hmm. What that does, if I were to say, like, you would ask me to do something and I say no, and then I say because, which pretty much almost every parent does, right? But if we say no, and then because, the second the brain hears no, cortisol is released in the brain. It puts us, which puts us into a state of hostility and distrust. Even if it's an amicable conversation, we have this chemical in our brain putting us in this state that we have to fight while we're trying to stay in conversation. So one of the biggest things is that you are right to your point. We leave out facts, but we leave out facts and then we also leave out the explore. Explore is the most important part. So when we start with the evaluation, especially if it's negative, we go into a state of hostility and distrust. Even if the facts behind it, when people say no, because, and the because makes sense, the person who's hearing it has to really struggle to hear those facts because the cortisol is already putting them in the state of hostility and distrust, right? Now, going back to what you said about AI, AI is connecting with the heart. So if I look at I have a model in my book that shows this, where it's, you have the facts, explore, which is emotions, I put a heart symbol, and then evaluation, I have a head, like the brain, right? And then decide. Think about it from sales. In sales, you want to ignite the heart so that the head will want to come up with a reason to buy, right? If you connect with the heart, if you get someone emotionally connected, the head will do everything it can to justify making that purchase. At the same token, if the heart feels in danger or is threatened, the head is going to become the massive protector. It becomes an army that goes around the heart to protect it. So when we hear no, right? The instant thing that on the person on the receiving end, their brain wants to protect their heart from being hurt, right? So now let's go back to AI. AI is all about connecting with the heart. I love going into like my ChatGPT. I'll say, what do you think of this? And it tells me immediately, gives me an emotional reaction. That's awesome. You're wonderful. Oh, that could cause a problem. You might want to reconsider this, but this is why. But oh, I can really feel your pain on this one, or I can really feel why you're doing this. Whoever designed AI was brilliant, because AI is designed to connect to the heart, and that's what's missing in our society today. And it's missing out of our conversations. We try to go from facts to evaluation. We'll say like, no, because, or we'll even say, well, here's the situation and this is why we're going to go that way. But when we skip what I call exploring, you know, the heart and the experience, that's when people disconnect from each other.
I hear what you say about AI, and that's why it's so addicting, right? I mean, I was just meaning that, you know, and that's to Brent's point, why we, you know, so many people are going to have relationships with their AI. It's just validating. It's a mirror. It tells you what you want to hear. All of those things that, you know, can be good and can be scary. And now what you're saying about conflict resolution and this whole idea that, yes, we've never been more polarized than we are now. I'd never seen anything like it. When I was growing up, I didn't know if people were a Democrat or a Republican. It didn't matter. I had voted on both sides. Like, it was the person. It was the issue. We are certainly not there anymore. I think what would be interesting with this feed process, because it's so powerful and really simple, but if you're not doing it, it's advanced, right? Because the like you said, the cortisol kicks in. You know, we start telling ourselves stories, and so we lose the connection. Can you give us an example of maybe how you've used the feed process in a really tense situation?
I was asked by the State Department back when President Bush was in office to help with some of the human trafficking issues in the Middle East. And so I was there doing some work And it was also the Arab Spring. So I was also asked to do some work between, I was doing some mediation between Sunnis and Shias. And it just so happened when I was in Bahrain during this time period, it was the morning of Muharram, which is the probably, I don't want to speak for Shias, but I think it's the most important Shia holiday, right, of the year. And it's a 10-day process. And people go down and they actually close off the streets at night. And, you know, people go and they mark, you know, they kind of, you know, walk in the streets and they mourn the passing of Imam Hussein, who was, it was actually, I think, during that battle, you know, decades and decades and eons ago, where Sunnis and Shias took two separate turns. And most Shias are from Iran. They, you know, they originate from Iran. And so a lot of my Shia friends in Bahrain were Iranian. And I went down, they invited me to see the morning of Muharram. And the energy is just palpable. I mean, people actually, they have tables on the streets that if anybody wants to use different instruments where they can, in a way, flog themselves so that they can connect to the pain of the loss of, you know, I don't want to speak again for, you know, for Shias, but like, the, you know, the passing of Imam Hussein. But it's very intense. I mean, very, very intense. The energy is palpable. You would have thought that he had just died the day before. And I'm down there and I'm experiencing like thousands of men in the streets. And my friends kind of take me off to the side and we're having a conversation. And I think it was really the emotion of the moment. But all of a sudden I find myself in this dark alley with, you know, surrounded by just, you know, my these men. One I knew, the rest were his friends I didn't know. And they kind of circle me and they start like shouting in my face, like, this is what the West doesn't understand. You know, we aren't afraid to die. Imam Hussein died for us and we will die for, you know, for our children. And this is what the West doesn't understand. And you can bring your nuclear bombs and you can threaten to bomb us, but we're going to come back and we don't care if we die. You know, we don't. And I'm just sitting here thinking to myself, I want to go home. I want to go hug my son, who I think was like 2 years old at the time. I want to go home. And, but I also was in this moment, right? It was like 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And so again, what I was hearing from them was their evaluation and their reaction to what was going on. So my favorite question to bring people out of that position, when people are in a position, right? An evaluation and a decision is a position. And sometimes we take these positions and we battle against that position and we start to argue, but that doesn't usually help, going back to our point of our world. But my favorite question in that moment is, tell me more, right? When you ask someone, tell me more, it takes them out of their position and into what their experience was that led them to that position. And in that experience, we can find connection. That's where we can become human to human again. So in that moment, I asked him, I said, tell me, help me understand. Tell me more about Imam Hussein. Tell me, I can feel the passion. I can feel the love. Can you please tell me more about him? And the second I asked that question, he said, Imam Hussein died for us and I would die for my child. And I could relate to that because I would die for my child. And then the conversation shifted. And then all of a sudden, when I asked him that question saying, tell me more, help me understand, that brought him back into his experience. Right. And then I shared my experience saying I would die for my child too. And we were back to being friends. And all of the intense, like at 1 minute, it was almost like we're Iranian American. And now we're two friends again. And the relationship stayed intact.
The to me, it's just this question of laddering, really. It's right. And I don't know if that's how you think about it, Jelaine, but to me, it is, you know, if I'm here and you're here, but at least in some ways, those two things, which might feel polar opposite or at least very different, ladder up to a set of common values, right? It's there's whether it's safety, whether it's respect, whether it's affirmation, whether it's you know, any one of a number of sort of core values. And so it's weird. It's like the disagreements happen when things get lost in translation. The thing that you and I both care about manifests in these completely different ways. And so we get stuck in the manifestation of it. Like, I think I'm just saying with really long words, what you're saying in a much more elegant sort of way. Is that right?
We all have values. And the thing about values, They're all positive. Values are 100% positive.
That's interesting.
And we can connect and go back to the fact that we actually have the same value. We all care about life. We care about our kids. We all want people to be happy. We want people to be able to live their dreams. Those are the values that we all share. How we get there, the approach is different. But going back to like when we talk about the discord, and this is, I don't think this is in my book, so this will be special for the podcast, right?
There you go.
Is how we have gotten so polarized. And so when I used to work in deep conflict, and I've worked in a lot of conflict zones, there is a path to, you know, we can call it just war or even genocide, right? But it all comes, it's five steps. The first step, if we want to move into a war or even a genocide type of, you know, framework, is the first thing people do is they avoid people who they feel are different than them, right? That's the first thing, is that we just won't talk to people. And we see this in school. I remember when I was working a lot in race relations, it wasn't even that anyone, you know, didn't like somebody else, but as a human being, we have a tendency to be drawn and to interact with people who we feel the most comfortable with, people who are just like us. So you go into a school lunchroom and you might see kids divided by race or religion, not because they didn't like each other, but because they just gravitated to where they felt most comfortable. So to me, the first step in stopping, you know, violence and conflict and, you know, discord is let's make each other more comfortable with people who are different than us, right? That's number one. Number two is once we start avoiding people, then we start to use verbal slurs. That is the number one issue in our society today, is the name calling. We don't say, you know, because name calling, slurs, is dehumanizing. As a human being, I can't hurt Sherry. I can't hurt Brent. You two are human beings. But back when I worked in the Rwanda during the genocide, if you're a cockroach, I can hurt a cockroach. I can kill a cockroach. I do kill cockroaches, which is what the Hutus called the Tutsis, right? So a cockroach can die. We can feel comfortable killing a cockroach, but I couldn't kill Sherry. She's a mom. She's my friend. She's a woman. She's a person. So slurs are the number one thing. If we could eradicate one thing in our society today and just take out of the human experience, it would be the name calling. And even when I worked in domestic violence, I never heard a man say, "Oh, I went home and I beat my wife, Sally." It was, "I beat that." You know, insert any word you want, right? Yeah. So that's the second level. So the first level is that we avoid people who we think are different or who we're not comfortable with. Then we create verbal slurs. And we even do this in sports. I mean, how many people say, "Oh, I hate that team." And they call them names, right? We tend to have to put slurs or whatever in front of us, whatever we dislike. So one is versus we avoid. Second is the slurs. And then third is discrimination. That's when we actively discriminate against someone. We don't invite the kid to the party because we don't like what religion they're from or what country they came from. So they're discriminated against. Now we've been avoiding, we've been using slurs, and then we actually discriminate. And then from there, it moves into violence. And then the last stage would be war or genocide. And I'm really scared where we are today. Because we're definitely, we've gone past we're entrenched in the avoidance of others. We're entrenched in the name calling and the slurs, and we're seeing the discrimination, the violence, and I'm very concerned for some serious discord.
How much do you think social media is, you know, causing this, and certainly foreign powers are causing this and working very hard to polarize our country? Again, when I grew up, even just calling people, "Oh, the Dems," you know, talking about the Democrats, that's a slur, right? And certainly you and I being Jews, I mean, we've been through this in World War II, you know, the Jews, the other, and we're always looking at the other. First of all, this is what we're going through in this country right now. But when you're working on a micro level, and this is so ingrained because it's happening on social media, it's happening in our country, we go into an organization and you work with them. Is it just by calling out these steps and by calling out the naming? Is that how you're creating transformation when you're actually working with teams? Or is it something else? Like, what's your process?
Well, I want to back up to one thing you said about social media, because I think this is really important. Because I think we could change it. Actually, I never thought about that until this conversation. Social media was designed, especially back when we called it Twitter, or now it's X, to simply give a short evaluation, right? To give your opinion. That's what social media was designed for, to give, like, you know, just an opinion or a judgment or a thought on something. I wish we could change it to say my experience. There'd be very little conflict, or we could reduce conflict when we say, "Well, my experience was this," because you can't argue with someone's experience. And then someone could come back and say, "Well, my experience was this." And then you can find common ground. But all of social media, and I feel like that is one of the biggest dangers in our society today, is that it comes out with just a soundbite. It was designed to just be a one or two liners, my opinion, and then people debate. and they debate and they have no idea how they got to that opinion. And that's the problem is that. And so again, I would like to put tell me more as a phrase and embed it in every single person's, you know, psyche, because when you see someone given a judgment, instead of reacting to it, because that's the problem, right? We react to what someone says, even if it means the relationship's going to go sideways. And here's where we're foolish. When we react without knowing how a person got there, well, then we're just as bad as that person in a way, right? Like if someone says, totally. I hate Trump or I hate the Dems, and you argue, well, you're wrong and this is why, you have no idea how they got there. Whereas if we could just sit back and say, so can you know, tell me more, help me understand what it is.
Not to mention the fact that we're looking at different facts, you know, lately, like,
right.
You know, we're on the plane and you're looking, are people watching CNN or Fox? What literally, when I'm on a plane, like right. I can go back and forth if I want to watch the news because I don't want to be judged. And
you get labeled for it, right? We immediately are. And so here's the other piece. We don't live out of facts. We live out of stories. And by the way, this is really important. If you want to talk about what causes conflict in our world, a fact is boring, right? A fact doesn't have any energy around it. It's not good or bad. It just is. The brain does not let us just sit with a fact, right? If I'm walking down, say, a trail with Sherry, and I see a mountain lion, I see a mountain lion. It's not good or bad. It's just there, right? Then I'm going to go into what I call explore, the emotion, which is our limbic system, and my brain's going to be like, and then my evaluation's going to be like, I could die. If I keep walking that direction, I could die. He's hungry. He wants to kill me. I'll start thinking all kinds of thoughts. And then I make a decision based on the story. So that thought that I have is a story. Oh, he's hungry. He's stalking me. He wants to kill me. Or maybe my story is he's perfectly fine. I'm just going to sit here and just let him pass. Whatever story I create based on what that fact of seeing the mountain lion ignites in me, that story that my brain creates to make meaning of seeing this lion in front of me. And then I the actions I take will be based on the story, not on the lion. It's based on the story that I create about that lion. And the brain requires that. That is survival. If we did not create a story to the facts that we see, we would not survive. Right. So we have to be able to look at something and immediately have a feeling about it, like, oh, this is dangerous or it's okay. And then we have to, we create a story. If it's dangerous, here's why. So here's the actions you need to take. If it's okay, here's why. And then we stay engaged. So the stories that we create are the number one reason for the discord in our country, because we are not debating facts, we're debating stories.
You know, let's make it personal. There's about 50 things I'm processing simultaneously here, but there's on this one though, if one were to say, I feel depressed, that may be more or less a fact. The fact that that's how they perceive their feeling is to feel depressed. But if someone says, I'm sorry, you've just created a story, right? I'm sorry that you feel depressed, because now what essentially is like the narrative that you've essentially created in your head is like feeling depressed is a bad thing. And that needs to be fixed, or that you're somehow broken, right? And for those of us who either struggle with mental health or been around people who struggle with mental health, I think there's always a story that immediately gets created that somehow you're broken and that you need fixed, right? And so a lot of the language that people use to try to be empathetic or sympathetic immediately creates these stories that actually position you in a way that maybe you never intended in expressing that feeling in the first place. I don't have a PhD in psychology.
Very interesting what you just said.
Right?
We're right. Like,
right?
Society shames us, right? And for a long, so often, we don't want to talk about those things. And then we give stories for ourselves and judgments to ourselves.
Oh, we do all this for ourselves all the time.
We do it
for ourselves.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and that's what a brand is, right? A brand is a story. Yeah. And so we're always conscious of our personal brand. And that is a story. And that goes back even to leadership too. Like if you don't control your own brand or your story, or if you're in a position of having to defend or justify yourself because someone else picked up on your story, whether it's depression or whatever, and they create their story around it, that's another piece that I feel is so important, is that we need to be in front of the narrative. I always train my leaders, like, you need to own the narrative, because if you're ever in the position of having to defend or justify what people are saying about you, somebody else owns your story. Right. But also we're living in a society where we can't even sometimes have even real conversations. Like when you talk about depression, I took an Uber not too long ago, and the Uber driver was a teacher by day, Uber by night. And she was telling me, she told a story about something, but she used the word unalive. And I was like, wait a minute, can you back up? And she's like, oh yeah, we're not allowed to say suicide anymore. We have to say the person is now unalive because suicide is triggering. And suicide is just a word. But the story, the attachment that we have to that word and that the stories that we create. So, but now we're almost taking things to an extreme by saying unalive versus dead, because we also don't want to trigger somebody. So there's so many different layers to this because it's going in so many different directions. I'm wondering how we're going to rein it back in.
Haven't we gone too far? I mean, with all of this as a society, you know, I was telling Brett, we were working with a Fortune 500 client, brand name. He knows the story. I think I've told this to you too. But, you know, we're doing the masterclass. And literally at the end of the masterclass, I get a call from HR. And they said, Sherry, we need to talk to you. You told a story about your black dog, Remy, and one of our participants was offended. And I'm like, oh my God, like, you know, I gave color to my dog. And you know, all I could do is make a little joke and say, well, I like cats equally. I don't understand what's going on here. But like, and then the second week, they said, you said the word dyslexia. It was very, very upsetting to people that some people have dyslexia. I was just talking about an ad or talking about something else. And then the third time, somebody was offended in that company because I said the word hurricane, because there was a hurricane in Florida and somebody got offended. And, you know, so I guess, you know, that going back to what you were saying about the story people were telling themselves, so many people are telling themselves right now, I'm offended. That's not right. This group isn't being taken care of. They're the underdog. They're this. I guess my question to you is, how in the world do we change the story and do we change the narrative with 10,000 pounds of social media reinforcing everybody's views, which is exactly what's going on today, and telling them, and then their AI, to your point, saying, great question. You're right. They're wrong. You should be offended.
Well, let's talk about, I think, what the most important part of that is. And that to me is that because we don't live out of facts, we live out of stories. So the greatest power we have is the story that we have about ourselves. I always tell people, if you want to change your life, you want to change your experience, start with changing your story. Because if we carry a story, if someone tells us a story about something and we carry it and hold on to it, then that, it's called mirror neurons, but people reflect that back. Let me give you an example. When I was first asked to go to South Africa, it was 1996. Apartheid ended in 94, and I was asked to train police in South Africa. Now, you all have seen my name. My name is very odd. They didn't know what race I was or, you know, whatever. Like, just, you can't put me in a box with my name. I show up in South Africa, and the government had hired me, but I show up in a community situation, and I walk into the room, and everyone's just staring at me. And I'm like, hi, you know, what's going on? And someone did say to me, they said, you're white. And I'm like, I am. And they said, why would our government, after apartheid ended, bring another white person, especially from America, an American white person, to do anything here? And I was immediately self-conscious of that. I mean, so that whole trip, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, here I am, a white American in South Africa who just ended apartheid. The last thing they need is a white American. And as long as I saw myself as a white American, that's the feedback I would get. That's mirror neurons. I do a session and people wouldn't say anything negative. They'd say, oh, for a white American, you're really, you know, you're good or whatever. But they would reflect back that story. When I changed my story, even though I didn't have it until they gave it to me in a way, but I embraced the story that they put on me. This goes back to Brent, your point about like even the depression. When I took on the story they offered to me, I was seen. Then I was constantly seen as that story. But when I got to a point inside of myself, when I realized, wait a minute, I'm here because I have something to offer. No one ever mentioned my race or being American again. Then it was always about the tools. And actually, when I left South Africa, they ended up having this little great celebration for me. And they, you know, and I mean, they gave me this really great compliment, which embarrasses me to say because there's nothing even remotely close to the situation. But they said to me in this card, we call Mandela the people's president, but you're the people's lady. And it hit me so hard because I went from being this white American, like, how dare they bring a white American, to really being seen for what I wanted to be there for, right? Like I felt seen at that moment, that I was there for the right reasons and they felt it. So I always say, you know, if we want to change a story, we have to change our own story. So when people give you a story and they tell you that's who you are, this is what we think about you, we have a choice. We can take that on. Not a good idea. Or we can like get really clear and say, what is my real story? And the second we get clear about our story and we're really 100% clear on it, you'll never hear it again from somebody else.
Here's the question I wrote down, is who defines difference? Because that whole ladder that you laid out, which is you avoid those people who are different, which leads to dehumanization, which leads to slurs, which leads to active discrimination. All that starts with a moment where someone has defined.
It's a story.
Yeah. Right. And to me, one of the things is, so my background is linguistics originally. So where I get really interested in is how can I use language to bridge gaps of difference? So one of the things I've done in training, college graduates in their 20s going out talking to senior executives, you know, who are heads of sales or heads of marketing, for example, is to change your pronouns from you to we. And I said, and they will, it's funny how you can change your story literally by changing your pronouns. One of the things we find as heads of marketing is like, now they know you're not a head of marketing, but they'll grant you that moment, they'll kind of suspend disbelief for just a moment and incorporate you in. And now what you've done is essentially you've diminished difference rather than exacerbated it, right? And so there's, so the things you can do with stories, one of the tools in your toolbox for story creation is language choice, isn't it?
Yes.
And so it's really interesting how the two go together.
Well, and there's two things with it, right? So one is language choice, and that is really important, especially again, the language you use on ourselves. But the other piece is that we as human beings, we want to feel good about ourselves, right? We want to feel right about what we think or believe or feel. And so when it comes to when we talk about conflict, and it's one of the major reasons why we have so much conflict in this world, is someone will create a story and we want to feel right about that story. So what do? We talk to other people. And the moment we talk to somebody else and they agree with our story, we no longer think it's a story. We think it's factual. As long as we have one or more people who agree with our story, then we start treating that story as if it's fact. And then we take action and we feel not just morally right, but oftentimes morally righteous in our rightness because other people agree with us. And that is the biggest danger today. So if you think about it, going back to that levels of genocide, we avoid people who we think are different. So that means that we're connecting with people who think like us, who are then embracing those same stories about the other, whoever the other is, right? And then we get validation. So if they feel this way and I feel this way, then this isn't a story. This is factual, right? Yeah. And so when we take action, we don't just feel right. I find that people feel morally righteous in how right they feel. And that is what's hurting us the most. So we have to be conscious of, one, the story that we tell ourselves, and then two, be really careful about looking for validation. Because when we look for validation, here's the thing about stories too that I find in organizations. People can go, and I call it building an army. I call that validation, building an army. People can like be upset with something that's happening at work, and they can go talk to a colleague and they build an army, right? The person agrees with them and they build an army. And then if they act out with passive aggressive or whatever it is, they feel justified for it. The problem is when we build an army around a story, we're not problem solving. We're still keeping our stress doesn't go down. We might feel better in that moment, whether we're building an army with AI, because AI is a big army builder, which I, by the way, that just is a new revelation on this podcast, because I hadn't thought about AI as being an army builder, but it is, right? Because it emotionally validates our perspective. Sure. So once we have that, once we feel validated, then we take action, we think that we're right about it. And so the way, you know, we need to, one, look at our own stories, but two, be really conscious of not seeking and not being an army builder. And we can do that as people. We can have personal integrity that I could go to Sherry and say to Sherry, you know what, Brent, you know, Sherry, I need to talk to you about Brent because I was really...
You wouldn't be the first.
I was really offended by what he said. And I can either say I was really offended and I want Sherry to validate me and say, yeah, I felt the same way. Or I can have personal integrity. And then I could like, and if she didn't validate me, I could then say, well, yeah, then we need to get rid of Brent. Hey, maybe you and I should just be partners and let's get rid of this guy because he's X, Y, and Z, right? Or I can take personal responsibility and have a little personal integrity, right? And I can go to Sherry and say, hey, Sherry, you know, I had a conversation with Brent and it didn't go well. I'm not looking for you to agree with me because that's not going to help. What I'm looking for is I need some ideas from you on how I can go have a conversation with Brent so that he and I can get to a better place. That is problem solving. And that's what we need to do as people.
We're all in a business where we're moving forward and we're looking not to blame, but to correct and to have that future conversation. I guess my question is, there are so many people who have maybe had trauma early in life, and their go-to default behavior is blame and not to take responsibility. And it goes deep, and it goes maybe way back to their childhood. And I've always said that it's a lot easier to be mad than sad, right? Because when we're mad, we get to blame somebody else. It's not our fault. And talk about pronouns. We change the pronoun. They did this to us. And this is what happens in our country. Those people, this group made this happen instead of, you know, I in taking responsibility. My question to you is, yes, we need to change our stories. Yes, companies need to change our stories. But is it ever so deeply ingrained that some people and some organizations just sort of default to blame? And we're addicted to it. Because I know people, I have friends, I have colleagues that every time we talk to them, it's like, oh God, I can't believe this is happening. It's like, oh, woe is me. And they almost get off on the validation, right? Like they like, oh God, that must be terrible. You're having 20 people for Thanksgiving in your second home and you're busy cooking. I feel so bad. These aren't like big problems. Right. And I know a lot of people that behave this way. And it's like, that's just their go-to. How do you undo that? Like, because it might be really deep.
Well, so first of all, let's go back to what you first said. I love what you said when you said we'd rather be mad than sad. That goes back to my, what I know you know in sales and what I know from psychology is that the head wants to protect the heart, right? Mad is a brain emotion, is a thought, is a head thing. Sad is a heart thing. So if the heart is sad, the brain wants to protect the heart because being sad is not a good experience. We're more energized. We can do more and act more when we're mad versus when we're sad, right? So that's number one with that piece. The other piece, though, is that that's where I love like the techniques of like saying like, tell me more. So, that to me, tell me more is a mindfulness practice. When someone comes at me with something negative that I find myself feeling emotionally charged and I want to react to, When I ask the person, tell me more. I'll give you an example. This one is in my book. But one of the first stories in my book was, again, it's a South African example. When I was working in South Africa, I was training police. And there was a situation where this little girl had gotten off the bus. And South Africa was the rape and murder capital of the world at the time. Kind of still is. That's a story, by the way, but I just said it anyway. So this little girl had a really, let's just say she had a really bad experience. And I just happened to have all 9 police commissioners in a room together the next week. And so I asked the guys, and they're from, all different races in South Africa. And I asked the guys, I said, okay, guys, what are you going to do about this? Because we've been working together for 2 years. I wanted to see if anything that we had been talking about was actually going to go into action. And the first response I got from one of the men was, where was her mother? If her mother hadn't been working and had been there when she got off the bus, this would have never happened. It was her mother's fault. When I heard that, I had a visceral reaction. Okay. And I was thinking there's a lot of things I could say in that moment to put him in therapy for the next 20 years. But I also knew he was giving me his opinion, his evaluation. And I had no idea how he got there. So had I reacted, which is what most of us do, when we feel that emotional, visceral response, it would have gone sideways. But that's when I used tell me more. So in that moment, I said to them, I said, tell me more. Help me understand what you mean by that. And then another man jumped in and he's like, it's gender equity. Gender equity has destroyed the fabric of this nation. Again, an evaluation that told me nothing. So again, I asked the question, tell me more. And by the third or fourth time, the real story came out where one of the men said, let me explain, I think we need to explain our situation to you, which was under apartheid, if you're a person of color, man of color, whites could do whatever they wanted. They could pay us, not pay us. They could, force us off the sidewalk in the street. They could spit on us, whatever they wanted to do, right? We had no power. So we felt emasculated. Now, post-apartheid, we have a constitution that's one of the best in the world, but it's really about also promoting gender equity. So now we feel like as men, when we were, first we were emasculated under apartheid, and now we're feeling emasculated post-apartheid because if we go up against a woman for the job, the woman will get the job. The second I heard that, I just melted. you know, all of a sudden I could feel just the pain and the fear and just, I mean, I can't relate to it as a white woman from America, but oh, I felt it in that moment. And I just softened. I had no more anger. It just left my body. Mm-hmm. And then I allowed them to talk for a minute. And then they said, wait a minute, guys, we all have mothers and sisters and daughters and wives. The women that we love need us to be their partners. We have to do this differently. And it was at that moment where I really saw real change start to happen. But that change would have never happened had I reacted, right? And that's how I have a lot of political conversations even today. I have friends who I can't mention certain political leaders or they have a visceral response, right? It's become so intense that we can't, you know, that they don't want to even have a conversation. But if I go, you know, if we go back and tell me more, let's just talk about the issue. Let's forget the person involved, but let's just unpack this a little bit. We actually find that we feel the same way. We may not like the approaches that are happening, but we do believe that the same problem needs to be solved. We don't like how the approaches to solve it, right? But as long as we react, we're never going to get there. So we have to, I mean, I believe that we all have to train ourselves in tell me more. Like, I feel like that's the one thing that could change humanity right here is if we were just to say, when we find that visceral reaction, tell me more, help me understand. There's a connection that occurs at that moment.
I think you've nailed it in so many different ways. But in nailing it, I, if nothing else, feel yet even more concern about, well, that ain't ever going to happen. So I'm wondering if maybe we could end on like the note of optimism. So are you an optimist, a pessimist? So if this is what good looks like, or the solution looks like, or at least better, let's call it just better. If this is what better looks like, right? Are you optimistic that we can get to that? So one, there's a practical question of like, you've got this really nice practical solution, which is now in book form. I can totally relate, having just published a book myself. It's like, there's a question of scale. Like, how do I literally just get the whole world to know about this and do it? But even like outside of the context of your book and your ideas, just for the world, I mean, give me some hope. Maybe that's what I'm asking for you. Just, could you give me some hope that we can find our way to this better place that you describe?
So let me close with a story, but it's not my story. This is a baseball story, and it's about three umpires. One is a rookie, one is a journeyman, mm-hmm. and the other is a master. And it's after a game one night, and these three guys are kicking back and having a couple of beers, and the rookie wants to impress the other two, right? So he's like, you know, he goes, when I'm out there on the field, I always call it like it is. That's right, he goes, I call it like it is. And the journeyman looks at the rookie, and he's like, yeah, you know, when I was a rookie, I used to say I call it like it is. Now he goes, I'm a journeyman, and I call it like I see it. That's right, he goes, I call it like I see it. And the master is just sitting there chuckling to himself. And he's like, so they turn to him, right? And they said, well, what do you think? You know, and he's like, well, when I was a rookie, I used to say I call it like it is. And when I was a journeyman, I would say I call it like I see it. Now he goes, I'm a master, and it ain't nothing till I call it. And that is the power that we have as human beings. That is my optimism. We as human beings, if we could just realize it, we have a choice. We can be a rookie and go around saying that's just how it is, can't do anything about it, and be that victim that Sherry mentioned earlier. Or we can evolve to the point of realizing, wait a minute, this is how I see it. Or we can all choose, and it's a choice. It is a choice. And we can become masters and realize it ain't nothing till we call it. And let's make that call. So that's what I hope for. I want to turn everybody into a master of themselves, their life, and how they choose to show up in the world.
I think we all need to get more of you, Jelaine, and more of your energy. And that's why I love spending time with you. And the audience is going to want to know, how can we get a hold of you? People are going to want to hire you. They're going to want to talk to you. They're going to have you do conflict resolution, because God knows there's not a company, a family, a business that doesn't have conflict, that doesn't need tell me more. So tell us more. Tell our audience, how can we find you, get in touch with you, hire you, be your friend, or at least go on a dog walk with your two gorgeous dogs not yet mine to talk about?
Well, first of all, I mean, of course, I have to do a little plug for my book, which just came out.
There it is.
Lead with Conversations. And it actually has every single tool. I've been told that it reads like an action novel, because every chapter is, and I, is just a story, right? I use stories and then I show the tool. And I've also been told that Americans, you know, that nowadays we have an attention span of 5 minutes. So every chapter is like a 5 to 7 minute read, but every tool is in this book. And then yes, please. I mean, our website is leadwithconversations.com and you can email me or find my phone number there. And I would love to help any organization. I'm really proud of an organization that I just worked with that for a year, they do like a 360 evaluation and they were always like 3 to 5 points below the company average. And this is a Fortune, you know, 100 company. And this year they're 3 points above the company average. And it just makes me happy because they had to deal with so many different fires and crises and everything that everybody always has to deal with. But what's different now is they know how to stay in relationship while they do it. And it just shows, it shows, right? So that's my mission in life. I want everyone to stay in relationship, whether it's with your kids, your spouse, or at work, or your animals, whatever it is. I want all of us to be able to have disagreements, but still stay in relationship so we can move ourselves forward. That's my mission. And I'm here to help.
It's a good mission. Jelaine, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jelaine.
So Sherry, I've got a question for you. So I know Jelaine is a friend, and we talked about that a little bit in the podcast. You met her at, it sounds like a restaurant in Park City, sat down, you were introduced. At what point in the conversation did you know, I want to be this person's friend? Was this something she said? So just the way she talked in general, what was that moment?
It was energetic. I think it was more energetic. You know, it's exactly what she said. You know, you see somebody and I'm like, oh my gosh, she's like me. You know, she was, you know, very talkative, very energetic, very open. Very dynamic, being in the same field. I thought, oh my gosh, you do in leadership what I do in sales. We're a little bit like a peanut butter cup here. And, it quickly got into, talking about emotional things and personal things. And like, literally, I just told my husband, I'm not making dinner tonight. Like, get your own dinner, go to internet, like, go. Because I knew that I needed to take that moment and meet this human being. And then we started being dog walking friends and still are. And we'll literally go on a 45-minute hike that turns into 2.5 hours. And what I find really interesting about Jelaine is she really practices what she preaches. You know, well, of course, we always talk about politics and the state of the world. And she's got intel that people don't have. I mean, the girl works for the FBI. She'll tell me things and I'll go, what? And she'll go, oh yeah, we got to be really careful. Like, she's got into that, right?
Just to be clear for anyone listening, she doesn't share anything she's not supposed to.
No, of course not. But she also has different insights. And to her credit, she doesn't have beliefs that are so rigid. And she can see the good in the bad in any big political situation and really analyze what's going on and be open to new information. And I think that's why I loved her the most, because I love people that have strong opinions and have a lot of facts, as she said, but are still very open to, you know, looking at things differently and maybe having a change of opinion. And so she's a good listener.
You know, I wonder at some point, maybe in some of these episodes, at least if not all of them, we bring it back to this kind of idea of, I don't know, selling, since that's kind of at least where we started this whole thing. But I think it is a superpower of being able to live in complexity and to be able to be comfortable living in complexity, right? So there's this natural tendency, I think, in human relationships and dating and marriages and parenting and in politics and in sales, to just try to simplify things, right? To get things down to like, all right, what is this? Let's boil this down and let's get sick. Sometimes there is no boiling. It's just, you have to kind of live in the messy sort of soup of reality and be comfortable enough with it to find a way towards clarity in the complexity as opposed to despite it. I think I'm rambling now, but does that resonate with you?
It makes me think of, and people are complex, right?
Right.
And things are complex. And I don't know what show I was just watching, but you know, you look at some of the old Godfather movies, right? Mm. And they're like, they're these mob bosses that, you know, execute killings and horrific events. Oh, maybe it was, we were watching a Taylor Sheridan show. It was Linus, right? Okay. When you see Linus, it's so good. Taylor Sheridan.
Okay.
But you know, there's this scene. I don't want a spoiler alert, but the mob bosses, you know, they're killing people. They're, you know, murdering people in cold blood. And then you see a scene of them with their children and their dog, and you're like, oh. And then you realize that, you know, people are complex. And it's not black and white. And in children's books, you know, very often, you know, there's the villain, there's the good guy and the bad guy. And I think you're right. I think we sort of boiled, you know, issues down to good and bad, black and white, this party, that party, but there's nuances and it's complex. And that's who Jelaine is as a person. And I think to me, that was a lot of her message, is that people are complex. But when we listen and we break it down, and I want to just share a very personal moment.
Yeah.
Because I think we all find ourselves doing that, depending what our beliefs are and judging other people and judging other situations. And it's so easy to do. And this was during the pandemic. And I had just hired a new employee. I had met her on Zoom 2 to 3 months, and I loved her right away. Everything about her. You remember, I'm not going to use her name, but the first person that you met, and just dynamic, funny, young, she's just guy. And she came over, we were having a company retreat, and I remember this moment because we were actually in the pantry. The professional organizer, and she was looking at my pantry and telling me how to organize it. And she looked at me with these wide eyes. She says, I've been trying to tell you something. I need to tell you something, and I hope you don't fire me.
Oh, dear.
She said, I'm not vaccinated, and I'm not going to get vaccinated. And now you have to understand, my husband's a doc, right?
Yeah.
We were volunteering at the vaccination clinic. We got early vaccine so I could go back on the road again and work.
Yeah.
You know, and I was very involved in that. And thankfully, I took a breath, and I'm not saying I always do this. And I said a version of, tell me more.
Tell me more. Yeah.
And she went on to tell me why her beliefs, which I don't have to get into. And the more I listened to her, the more I loved her.
No.
And the more I realized that we were much more alike than we were different.
Mm-hmm.
Or that our values were absolutely the same. How we went about it were different. And after about 15 minutes of listening, I just hugged her. I have no boundaries with my employees or my client. I literally embraced her. And I think we like proclaimed our love right then and there. Like it was a moment. He's like, I just love you. You're such a great boss. I'm like, I love you. And, you know, we worked together for 2 years. I went to her wedding in Italy. And you know, I love her. But it was that moment. And again, it's not that I always do it. I'm human. But that I said, tell me more. I want to hear. And I think that's the biggest thing I heard from Jelaine, is that we're aligned in values. And I even do something in my seminars where I have people write down, what are the 3 most important things in your life?
Mm-hmm.
And the top 3 are the top 3. It doesn't matter what country you're in, what color people are, if they're black, white, left, right, the top 3 are always the top 3. And that's what I really heard from Jelaine, is how do we get there?
So what are the top 3?
Well, I'm going to turn around on you. What are the top 3 most important things in your life? Priority.
Pizza.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's one of them. Actually, it's sushi, but go ahead.
Chipotle.
Yeah.
I'm being a jerk. I apologize.
The Alan asshole says golf.
Yeah.
Wait, never when his wife.
I thought you said every once in a while an asshole says what, and then I was going to say what, and I thought you were playing a joke. That's like, a great joke. But the no, I assume it's what, family, kids, you know, it's not job. It's not, right. It's a classic thing of like, no one's on their deathbed saying, I wish I worked harder on my job. Right. It's human connection, I assume. Right. In some kind or another.
The top 3 that I see, and maybe it's the way I set it up, you're always going to get something about family. Always, always, always. You're going to get, you know, family, relationships, spouse. You're going to get something about health and wellness, maybe spirituality in there, depending where you are. If you're in the South, you're going to get more God, you know, et cetera, or in India, I've done it. You're going to get versions of that. Mm-hmm. And then you are going to get, it's not job, but it's sense of purpose. So it could be philanthropic work. It could be, oh my gosh, Jelaine, her sense of purpose, you know, real, like it's real. you know, a lot of people search for that. It's real. But the top three are always the top three. And I always say then, and I do this at the end of a keynote, you know, we're actually more alike than we are different. And then I'll make a joke. Like if it's a software company, I'll say, how many of you wrote down your CRM software? And then everybody laughs. You know, where the punchline is, we can't change somebody's life priorities in a sales conversation. What we can do is find out what their priorities are and eventually link our offering to it. It's going to give you more like time with family. It's going to give you, you know, whatever it is.
Yep.
But yep. I think that the point for Jelaine is how do we get there? How do we get to these common values? And she's got a methodology for doing it. What did you get out of the conversation?
Everything that I'm working on now in the framing sale is about frameworks, right? It's about how do you take things that are big and hard and overwhelming and putting some sort of frame around them such that they feel more manageable, doable. And what she's done is put a framework around human, finding human connection, right? Or finding common ground. We all kind of know it's urgent, but I think she lays out a particularly strong case for like, not only is it urgent, but it's achievable. And this is why I asked her the last question, which is I really, sometimes when you lay out just how distant we are and you know, disconnected from one another we are today, whether it's politics or whether it's AI or whether it's social media, whatever it might be, it's easy to become discouraged. And that's, so for someone who studies this as deeply and as completely as her, it's nice to know that she sees optimism. And so that makes me feel a little bit more optimistic too.
That's beautiful. And I know that the mental health question really resonated with you. And I thought the comment that you made was, first of all, very vulnerable of you, Brent. Very, I'd like to take a little bit more that way, I've noticed. Maybe I'm rubbing off on
back. Maybe.
At any rate, you asked her, you were talking about the stories we tell ourselves. And I thought you made such an interesting point when you said, you know, why are we telling the story that having depression is a bad thing? Why do we tell ourselves the stories? Because you and I have talked about this privately about, you know, you feeling, you know, you'd suffering from depression. And I've been very honest about, you know, my coming out about ADHD. And these are mental health issues, and the very label of it, which is also interesting because in her five-step approach, she said, you know, the first step is to avoid, you know, when there's conflict. And the second is to have a slur or a title. And it makes you wonder, do we, when we call ourselves, oh, I'm depressed, oh, I have anxiety, oh, I have ADHD, does that label create a story that we shouldn't be creating for ourselves?
I tend to agree. I mean, because we tend to more implicitly, but sometimes explicitly, talk about how do we fix it? What's the solve, right? Which if you think about it, the implication is it's broken. Like which means you're broken. And say, I don't think you're broken. But that doesn't mean we can't find ways to manage those things such that we can even, you know, maximize their utility and minimize the downside. But but to come from a position of how do I take what I'm given and get the greatest utility out of it? Maybe that's too cold and clinical, but hopefully you know what I mean. But not how do I take what I'm given and fix me? Do you know what I mean? Those are two very different stories in Jelaine's book.
They really are. And my mother used to say all the time that any strength is a weakness and any weakness is a strength.
Yeah.
And I think what you're saying, I don't like the utility word. It's sort of like that.
Sorry. Yeah.
What was that? Yeah. Oh, opacity, value opacity. But you know, then again, you're a linguist, so you have fancy words. Half of them.
I do.
And, but anyway, the point is that what you're saying that I really like is this whole idea that, you know, how do we look at it differently and say, okay, where's the strength in that? The yin to the yang. Depressive, but that also means this. But it's an interesting question. And what was that question that you woke up with one morning and that you asked yourself? I love that.
What if it's not a problem? Right. What if this is my superpower as opposed to my greatest weakness? That's that. Right. That's the And sometimes it feels that way and sometimes it doesn't. But what I think the one thing we conclude from all this is, one, you've got killer friends, and two, we need to bring them all on the podcast. So go find us another friend, Sherry. Go find us another friend.